From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, in our Wisconsin 2020 series, we answer listener questions about voting and voter suppression here in Wisconsin. Then we dive into the challenges facing the next Milwaukee County executive when they take over the post in April. An Arctic explorer gives his advice for dealing with frigid temperatures.
Physically, I don't think you need to be stronger than any other person to be able to withstand severe cold. I think you just need to be smarter and have a positive attitude and understand that you can be comfortable no matter what the conditions are.
And Swedish composer and singer Sophie Dunér performs with Milwaukee's Present Music.
I like to write melodies that are on the border of not being able to make it. So I feel like I can crash land or I can just break out and joy, you know, but you have to be able to know exactly where that happens. So it's risky, but I like risk in music.
Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Joy Powers. Although the general election is still months away, we're less than a week away from the spring primary election. Among other things, this election will decide which Wisconsin Supreme Court candidates will advance to the spring election this coming April. As part of our Wisconsin 2020 series, we've been asking you, our listeners, to tell us what you want to know about voting in Wisconsin. People have been particularly interested in so-called voter suppression tactics in the state, which is where we start our conversation with reporter Patrick Marley. He covers politics in the Wisconsin State House for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and he joins me now. Patrick, thank you so much for being here on Lake Effect.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
We got a lot of questions that kind of skirt around this same question, and I'd like to start here. People are very concerned about voter suppression, but there's some confusion about what that suppression really is. So break it down for us. When we're talking about suppression efforts, what are some of the things that we're bringing up here?
Well, I think the main thing to keep in mind is that what qualifies as voter suppression is in the eye of the beholder in most cases. You know, there's been a lot of debate in Wisconsin over its voter ID law, which has been in place since what was passed in 2011. It was held up in court for quite a while. But I think that critics of that law would contend it is a form of voter suppression because it requires extra responsibilities to get to the polls. This fight over the voter list, which has resulted in potentially some people coming off the rolls, there's a lawsuit over that. Opponents would cast that as voter suppression. But supporters of these things would say this is about election integrity. It's about making sure that the voting rolls are clean. And so, you know, it really devolves into a political debate pretty quickly.
So you mentioned some of the things like voter ID, which was passed. Some people say signing the poll book, that's a form of voter suppression. But the thing that has been brought up a lot this election, perhaps for obvious reasons, is the voter roll purge. So break that down for us. Where are we on that?
Sure. So in October, the Wisconsin Elections Commission sent letters to about 230,000 people who it believed had moved. It works with this group called ERIC, which a majority of states work with, that does things like when people notify the post office that they're moving, it gathers that data. When people register a vehicle at a new location, it grabs that data. And then it compiles it into saying that it appears these people have moved because of interactions they've had with government agencies. So the state sent these letters to people saying, we believe you may have moved. Please contact us to either confirm your address is currently accurate or that you have moved and update your registration with your new address. The Elections Commission's plan was to give people more than a year to respond to them, and then it was going to take people off the rolls if they hadn't either voted, confirmed their address, or updated their registration. So that would be in 2021 after the big presidential election. But there was a lawsuit by the conservative Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty that said people needed to come off the rolls much quicker than that. They argued that state law required people to come off the rolls 30 days after the letters were sent. And that's been in the courts since. There was an initial ruling that would have required people to come off the voter rolls, but that was stayed by an appeals court and is now before an appeals court. So for the moment, no one has been pushed off the rolls.
When is that going to appear before the court again?
So it's right now the appeals court is continuing to take briefs on it and will rule presumably sometime this spring. And then whatever decision it comes up with could be appealed to the state Supreme Court.
So at this point, no one has been removed from the list based on this mover list.
That's correct.
There is still a lot of concern from people that they're going to be removed or they may have been removed. And I know this is something, as you mentioned, a lot of states work with ERIC. This isn't something that's unique to Wisconsin. And I believe there is a way to check if your voter registration has been removed. Is that accurate?
That's correct. So one thing I'd say about the ERIC, many states work with them, but no other state takes people off the rolls as fast as would happen if this lawsuit succeeded. So most states give people I think 4 years before they take them off for having moved if they don't update their registrations.
So this would be atypical.
This would be atypical if this lawsuit were successful in terms of how fast people came off the rolls. But again, no one's come off the rolls at this time. That's all going to depend on this litigation. But to your main question, yes, people can check whether they're on this list. They can check what their current registration status is, and they can update their registration. So there's a website called myvote.wi.gov. It's a website run by the Wisconsin Elections Commission. You have to put in your name and your date of birth, and then it will tell you if you're registered and what address you're registered at. It will also include additional information if you were on the list of people who were sent letters in October. And from that website, one, you can see if you're currently registered at the correct address, and there's no question about whether you've moved, then you're in good shape. If you have moved, you can use that site in most cases to update your voter registration and put in the correct address. And if you are tagged as questioning whether you've moved and you haven't, you can rectify that on that website as well.
Now, you mentioned a bit of why people believe this voter roll purge should happen, why they believe it shouldn't happen. And we have gotten some pushback from listeners who've asked, you know, shouldn't the voter rolls be made as accurate as possible to guarantee that every election is a valid election? And some people are just confused about the basic opposition to removing these names from the voter rolls. Can you unpack that?
Sure thing. So the main thing to remember is that if someone moves, they absolutely need to update their voter registrations. You need to be registered at the correct address because you need to go to the right polling place and you need to get the right ballot. If you're registered at the wrong address, you know, you could show up at the wrong polling place, or you could go to the right polling place but get a ballot that's got race for state legislator or county supervisor for a district other than your own. And so that's why they send these letters, because they want to make sure their voting rolls are as accurate as possible. And that's why the supporters say it should, that people should come off the rolls if they haven't corrected their addresses. The other side of it is that this data is pretty good, but it's going to have some problems, as with any large data set. So, you know, sometimes people decide that they're going to register their vehicle at a business address. And they do that, they haven't actually moved, their voting status should stay the same, but this data would pick up that the car was registered at a new location and flag them as having moved. And so a past mailing from 2017, after the fact, election officials in Wisconsin determined about 7% of the people on the list should not have been on there, or the 7% had not actually moved. And so opponents of purging people from the list say, nobody should be taken off the rolls because of a bad data match, particularly someone who wouldn't suspect that they might be on this list because they hadn't moved and they wouldn't think of something like a vehicle registration as having affected their registration status.
Well, and it seems like in the last time that they purged a lot of names from the voter rolls, certain areas were impacted disproportionately to the rest of the state.
Well, I mean, certainly there was a bit of an outcry from clerks over confusion from the 2017 mailing and concern about some people getting flagged who shouldn't have been. And because of the way the 2017 mailing was handled, the Elections Commission took a new approach this time, giving people more time to respond. Of course, that, you know, has been drawn into question because of this lawsuit. You know, these mailings are going to affect populations that tend to move more often. So we did an analysis of this most recent mailing and found that a majority of them went to college campuses and large cities, which have populations that tend to move around more. They're younger. But also those are places that tend to vote Democratic. So we see that the mailings have landed in the communities where Democrats are more predominant than Republicans.
So taking kind of a left turn, this is a conversation largely just about different voting questions. And we got a question from a listener who said, you know, when I changed my address with the DMV, I didn't get a new license. This is likely somebody who might end up on something like a mover list. Should they bring a utility bill to the polling site to prove their residency? How do they prove their residency once they get to their polling place?
So it would depend. If you're registered at the correct address, you don't need to prove your residency at the polls. You do need to show all voters need to show an ID. The ID does not have to have your current address on it. So if you moved 6 months ago and you updated your registration, but you never changed your license to get the address change, that still qualifies as ID for the purposes of voting ID. Now, if you have not updated your registration and you decide to update your registration at the polls, which you can do in Wisconsin, you do in that case need to prove residency. And so that's an important distinction everybody needs to remember. Your voting ID for voting purposes doesn't need to have the current address, but if you register at the polls or whenever you register, you're going to have to prove that you live where you say you live. And what you can use there is if you've updated your driver's license, you can use your driver's license. You could also use a lease, mortgage document, bill from a utility. If you go to this State Elections Commission's website, you'll see there's a laundry list of many documents that can be used to prove residency, like the ones I just described.
So if you're someone who needs to absentee vote for whatever reason, how do you go about doing that?
Well, one thing to remember in Wisconsin, you don't need to have a reason to absentee vote. I mean, if you just choose to, you can absentee vote. We have no excuse absentee voting, unlike some states which require you to be, you know, show that you're going to be out of town or have an illness or something like that. All you need to do is contact your clerk. There's two types of absentee voting. One we just sort of refer to usually as early voting. That's where you go to the clerk's office, you fill out the ballot, you do everything all in person. And in some communities like Madison and Milwaukee, they have remote voting locations. So maybe at a library or another public place, they'll have a spot that may be closer than City Hall. But you'd need to go to your local clerk's website to find out, you know, what the hours are for early voting. You can call them and find out where the locations are. The other type of absentee voting, the more traditional type, is to do it by mail. That's where, again, you contact your local clerk and you tell them that you'd like an absentee ballot. They will send it to you. You fill it out, and then there's some additional rules beyond what you have when you go to the voting booth, such as you have to have a witness sign that you're the one who cast the ballot. You'll have to include a photocopy of your voter ID, and you need to mail it back to your clerk. You want to make sure when you send in your absentee ballot that you send it in with enough time so that it can get there by election day.
So the next election that we're approaching is the primary, and there are some high school students who are 17 who will be 18 by the time they are the general election. Are they able to vote in the primary?
You have to be 18 years of age to vote in any election. So the example you cited, that person could vote in the general election because they'd be 18 by then, but they would not be able to vote in the primary leading into that because they wouldn't have turned 18 yet. That's different in some states. Some states let you vote younger if you'll be 18 by the time of the general election. Not the case in Wisconsin.
So they'll have to wait until November.
Correct.
We got this listener question, and this wasn't actually something I knew that much about. I'm someone who takes selfies, I guess, with my voter sticker, but there are a lot of people who have been wanting to take photos with their ballot, and for a long time that's been illegal in Wisconsin. What's changing? Is anything changing?
Something could change. So there's been a long-standing requirement in Wisconsin you can't take a photo of a ballot, and the rationale for that is that it was meant to prevent someone from saying something like, hey, I'll give you $5 if you vote for this candidate, but you got to prove that you voted for that candidate. The idea was that you could prevent people from coming up with schemes to buy votes, essentially. And, you know, before cell phones, people weren't routinely carrying cameras with them into voting booths, and I think it just wasn't an issue. With the advent of Instagram and Twitter and Facebook, people are increasingly showing up in the voting booth, taking a photo just because they're proud of who they voted for and they want to show their friends and family and supporters. who they voted for. And so there's been this national conversation. A lot of states have laws like Wisconsin. Some of those laws have been challenged in court. Some of those laws have been changing. There's an effort to change the law in Wisconsin. In fact, such legislation recently passed the state Senate and could come before the state assembly, but the legislative session is winding up very quickly, and it's unclear if the assembly is going to pass it.
So you may be able to take a selfie, but it's unclear as of right now or not.
That's right. There's an election in February, and you can't do it for that one. And, you know, only if it gets through the assembly and gets signed into law by the governor would you be able to. At the moment, it's illegal.
So for right now, just settle on the I voted sticker selfie.
That would be the safer way to go. I don't know that this law gets prosecuted very much, but, you know, it is illegal. And if you were to do it, somebody might at minimum say something to you about it.
Yeah. Well, Patrick Marley, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Yeah, thank you.
Patrick Marley is a reporter covering politics and the Wisconsin State House for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We spoke with him as part of our Wisconsin 2020 series, which answers your questions about the election. Now we're asking you, what do you want to know about the candidates running in this upcoming election? What are some of the issues appearing on your ballot, and what do you want to know about them? You can submit your questions at our website, wuwm.com. We'll take a short break now, then we'll look at some of the many challenges facing the next Milwaukee County Executive. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. The spring primary is next Tuesday, February 18th, and one of the biggest races on the ballot is for Milwaukee County Executive. Chris Abley announced last October he will not be seeking re-election after holding the post since 2011. There are four candidates vying for the position: Pranima Nath, a local businesswoman, County Board Chairman Theodore Lipscomb, State Senator Chris Larson, and State Representative David Crowley. To give us an idea of some of the challenges that these candidates will face if elected to county executive, WUWM's Angelina Mosher-Salazar sat down with Rob Henkin, the president of the Wisconsin Policy Forum.
Rob, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So, Rob, given your intimate study of the county and its budget outlook, I'm hoping you can break down some of the most important responsibilities.
Well, I think the first and most pressing responsibility for the new county executive, who will take office in early April, is to start thinking about his next budget or her next budget that will go into effect in calendar year 2021. So clearly, the county's fiscal issues are the paramount challenge facing the new county executive. There's a set of fiscal challenges that have been building for many, many years. There has been some progress made due to a variety of circumstances over the past several years, but still, there's this nagging, stubborn $15 to $20 million structural deficit, and that's not chump change. Essentially, the conundrum in which the county finds itself is that every year at the start of budget preparation season, the question is not, gee, where can we invest some resources into programs and services that are working well or try to fill some gaps? Instead, it's where are we going to find $15 or $20 million of cuts this year?
That is a very dire situation for the county. And they also have to address a lot of issues. I know capital improvements, infrastructure. Can you talk about some of those issues that need some attention in this next budget cycle?
Sure. So I think infrastructure is a great place to start. The Wisconsin Policy Forum did a five-part series of reports examining both Milwaukee County and City of Milwaukee and sewerage district infrastructure. Our findings were not the type of findings that you're going to want to go out and celebrate. We are raising the alarm bells. There is a local government infrastructure here, and it is first and foremost a problem of Milwaukee County. We estimate there's about a $400 million backlog of infrastructure needs. Now, that doesn't mean that $400 million needs to be spent, but it does mean that some very difficult decisions need to be made in terms of which of the county's capital assets are going to be repaired and replaced based on existing replacement schedules, to what extent are major issues like a potential replacement for the domes, the need for a new safety building, how are those going to be resolved, and is there some county infrastructure that the counties simply cannot continue to afford to maintain, that simply is going to have to be somehow divested.
Aside from infrastructure, what else is going to be a major issue for the county exec when he's looking at how he's going to balance his budget?
Well, I think the perennial issues that receive the most attention are the transit system and the parks. And so one reason that both of those elements receive a lot of attention is that those are so-called discretionary services. The county does transit and the county does parks, not because state statutes require the county to do them, but because they're very important to the quality of life and the economy of this community. They do it on their own. But by virtue of that, they are essentially competing with one another for a very shrinking amount of locally generated resources. Most of those have to go to support the mandates, the things like the sheriff and the courts and mental health services and other social services. It leaves very little for transit and parks, and the budgets in both of those areas have been stretched over the years. There has been lots of discussion about whether there needs to be new forms of revenue to support those functions. And indeed, the county has acted on that with a $30 wheel tax that was implemented a few years ago. There have been some very controversial proposals to install parking meters at the parks throughout the county and so forth. But I think clearly that's where some of the infrastructure backlog has emerged. And in fact, the parks is the number one area where that's the case. But also just in terms of annual daily operations and the maintenance of existing transit routes and the maintenance of existing parks amenities and availability of parks resources for the community, this gets very just more difficult every year to maintain. And we will certainly have more discussion about whether we can afford to maintain our current levels of service in those areas.
I've been to those community listening sessions where people talk back to the county exec and say, hey, these are the issues that are important for us. And hands down, every time, there's always someone there representing from parks saying, this is important to us, don't take it away from us. I'm curious, what are some other issues that don't get as much attention, but the county exec is going to make some very important decisions on?
Well, I think, first of all, you have to look at why do we have these problems in county government? Why are these different service areas so challenged? And I think, you know, there are two glaring places that you need to look. Number one is the county's revenue structure. The county operates under a revenue structure that is essentially dictated by the state of Wisconsin. That's not very unusual, but what is unusual is the county's reliance on state aids that rarely go up and certainly fail to match the growth of the level of inflation. And at the same time, essentially the county has one primary local revenue source, and that's the property tax. And the county is allowed a half-cent sales tax, but it implemented that sales tax back in the early 1990s, and per state statute, it can't do any more than that half-cent. So this reliance on the property tax, coupled with the fact that state aids, for a variety of reasons, have been pretty much flat for several years, creates a big problem because there are expenditure pressures that actually exceed inflation. And that gets back to my number two glaring area, which is the county pension system. We know that there was a pension scandal back in the early 2000s that caused some considerable financial challenges for Milwaukee County. At various points in time in the intervening years, there have been steps taken that have sort of controlled the growth of that obligation. But it has steadily grown to the point that as we sit here today in the 2020 budget, the county is going to be devoting about $100 million out of a total $300 million property tax levy to support its pension system. So you have to look at those issues. But I think also under the radar screen is the behavioral health care system. And here, it's not as much day-to-day financial difficulties as some really big operational issues that are going to be facing the next county executive. The county is going to undergo a huge experiment. It is outsourcing and contracting now for all of its inpatient care.
And this is recent. This is a new development for the county.
Yes. So the decision was made a year or two ago, but the expectation is that by 2021 or 2022, the county will no longer be providing inpatient behavioral health services out of the mental health complex. Instead, will be contracting with a private provider that is building a facility in West Allis to provide those services. So how is that going to work is a key question. A very key related question is the psychiatric crisis service system. So the one psychiatric emergency room in Milwaukee County is run by the county out at the mental health complex. While they are outsourcing the inpatient beds, no decision has been made yet as as to what's going to happen with this psychiatric emergency department. The provider of the inpatient services is not going to be the provider of the psychiatric emergency department. So the question is, will we continue to have a single psychiatric emergency department or rely on the private sector EDs to handle that responsibility? If we are going to have some type of new ED, is that going to be county run or under some type of a public-private partnership? So this is a very big decision that has been under the radar for quite some time, but it's going to be staring this new county executive right in the face.
Many important decisions that this new county exec is going to have to take. Is there anything that is particularly unique about this new term compared to previous terms?
Well, I think one of the things about Milwaukee County is the fundamental problems here, the inflexibility of the revenue structure and the growth in the pension funding. These are not new problems. These are problems that have existed for several decades. The manifestation of these problems, however, has grown. And so it's sort of drip, drip, drip. Every passing year, the budget gets tighter. There is less fat, so to speak, to cut. And again, we were past that point probably 10 years ago with Milwaukee County. And so this structural deficit then portends the need to really have to consider service reductions. And, you know, there are no service reductions that any county executive is going to propose that are going to be popular at this point in time. We're talking vital services, including mental health and aging services and court and public safety services, plus very important quality of life services, ranging not only from the parks and the transit system, but to the public museum and the zoo. And so as this problem has built year after year after year, the decision making has gotten that much more difficult. So I don't envy the person who's going to be taking this office. In fact, we did our own candidates forum a couple weeks ago, and my first question for the candidates was, why in the world do you want this position?
That was my very next question. With this outlook, Rob, why would anyone want this position?
Well, you know, it's a very important administrative position. In an ideal world, it's a nonpartisan position. It's a position where somebody who wants to roll up his or her sleeves and make government work, you know, you have a lot of opportunity to do that. So, yes, the challenges are fierce. But also, you know, in terms of doing a job that is going to be critical for this community, I think there is, you know, no higher calling in terms of somebody who wants to serve the public.
Rob Hankin, thank you so much for joining me in the studio.
Thanks so much for having me.
That was WUWM's Angelina Mosher-Salazar speaking with the president of Wisconsin Policy Forum, Rob Hankin, on the unique and pressing challenges that lie ahead for whichever candidate will become the new Milwaukee County Executive. Coming up, we look at the challenges of working outside in the cold. An Arctic explorer gives his advice for dealing with frigid temperatures when Lake Effect returns in a moment on WUWM. More of Lake Effect Now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. With snow and ice covering roads and sidewalks, the best thing to do can be staying inside. But for many of us, that simply isn't an option. Delivery people, police officers, and EMTs are just some of the people whose work forces them to stay outside despite the weather. This is familiar territory for Eric Larson, a Wisconsin native and polar adventurer. His work has brought him to the North and South Poles, and part of his work is actually teaching people how to survive in sustained periods of deep cold. I spoke with him in 2019 about some of his tips for working outdoors in the winter.
One of the most important aspects of being outside in the cold is just having the right attitude. Physically, I don't think you need to be stronger than any other person to be able to withstand severe cold. I think you just need to be smarter and have a positive attitude and understand that you can be comfortable no matter what the conditions are.
So if you're someone who is, you know, pretty uncomfortable with cold just in general, what should you be doing to prepare yourself? What kind of clothing should you be wearing? How many hats? How many pants?
Yeah, I mean, I always say that there's no such thing as cold weather, just not enough layers. And so quite honestly, the biggest thing to prepare is just having enough gear and the appropriate gear. And so I generally tend to dress in layers, and so the colder that it is, the more layers that I put on. Generally, next to my skin is a light wicking layer, which helps keep moisture away from my body, and then I add several insulating layers of fleece or down, and then a shell to protect from the wind. And so again, depending on the temperatures, I can either add or subtract those layers.
So you mentioned a wicking layer. What is that for?
Well, quite honestly, the one of the biggest things that I'm always concerned about in extreme cold weather, because I'm generally working very hard, is getting too warm. Your body actually generates a lot of heat, and as soon as you overheat, you sweat. And that sweat next to your skin actually replaces the layer of insulating air that's right next to your body. And so having that wicking layer, that layer next to your skin that can pull moisture away from your body so that that warm air layer stays intact is very important.
That's something my boyfriend works for UPS. He's a UPS driver. And he mentions a lot of the time that he'll start, you know, sweating because he's lifting boxes in and out of these trucks all day. So if you have a layer that can kind of absorb that's a way to avoid that.
Yeah, not only absorb it, but pull it away from your body to the outer layers. And then equally important, I think, I really advocate for this idea of thoughtfulness in terms of cold weather. Very easily, you can overheat, as I mentioned. And I think what's very common is that people just assume that they're going to get too hot and then they start sweating. And so I kind of advocate this idea of thoughtfulness, as I mentioned, which is really as you start getting warm, taking layers off or unzipping or putting down your hood or whatever. Jokingly, I kind of call it the polar striptease. And as I'm traveling around in whatever cold weather environment, oftentimes I'm constantly modifying my layers and making adjustments just specifically so that I don't get too warm.
What are the biggest challenges when you've, you know, dressed at the beginning of the day and you're all bundled up? What are the biggest challenges as you work through your day as far as your clothing is concerned?
I think the biggest challenges are just keeping on top of all your systems and not relaxing so that you think you're in control of the situation and the environment. I think the ways in which I've seen most people get into either dangerous situations where they've gotten severe cold injuries or frostbite or potential survival situations is when you kind of relax and think that, oh, I'm just going to be fine or I'll take care of it later. And so this kind of constant diligence to keep on top of all your systems and to keep on top of managing your layers and your body temperature is probably the most important thing that you need to be mindful of throughout the day.
If you have clothing on that is getting water into it, is there anything you can do during the day to kind of fix that, or are you just kind of stuck until you get inside?
Yeah, I mean, you can get your clothes can get wet from both the inside from you overheating and from the outside when you're kind of in snow or wet conditions. It is hard at times to potentially dry that gear. That said, wet gear can dry in the cold. There's a process called sublimation where, you know, a solid moves into a gas. And so there have been times, for example, in the Arctic Ocean on the way to the North Pole where we've actually fallen through the ice into the water. And what we do is just keep traveling in the hopes that our clothes will dry out as we travel. That said, I think that diligence in terms of monitoring your own layers and making sure that you're not getting any snow inside your boots or your gloves or things like that is going to just help that process of keeping dry.
Do you have any tips that, you know, people who do work in the cold or have to be in the cold because it's just cold outside, do you have any tips that people might not think about?
Yeah, I mean, one of the biggest ways in which people lose heat in the wintertime is through their feet. And so just standing on a cold surface, you lose a lot of heat through conduction. So anything that you can do to insulate your feet from the ground is really important. Part of that might be adding an extra pair of insoles inside your boots. One of the things that you can also do if you're just simply standing in a spot for whatever reason or like ice fishing, you can stand on an insulated pad, like a foam pad, and that will actually help your feet stay warmer as well. that basic adage of putting on your hat, I think, is really important. So insulating your head. Oftentimes I see people that are cold that, you know, have their hood down and their zipper wide open. And so that's one of the first things that I tell them. I also think that, you know, one of the biggest ways to stay warm is just simply moving your body around. Your body generates a lot of heat. So if you are cold, moving around, running in place, doing jumping jacks can have a big impact as well. So there are a lot of subtle things, but, you know, overall, I think that's about it.
Yeah, when you're working with people for these expeditions, people who I'm guessing certainly aren't as experienced as you are with the extreme cold, are there things that tend to come up?
Yeah, I mean, I think the basic things that come up with everybody are just cold hands, cold feet. I think people are very concerned just about being outside all day. And oftentimes on my expeditions, we're outside in extreme cold, 30, 40, 50 below for, 10 or 12 hours a day. And so I think just being out for that long is very intimidating while trying to manage doing anything with their hands or feet or whatever. And so I think the hands thing is a real big issue. For me, I'm a big advocate of mittens over gloves, although I do use a lot of gloves in occasions as well. So there are a lot of these little tips that I think add to your ability to stay warm.
I've seen people doing things like putting surgical gloves underneath, you know, their mittens or like plastic bags in their shoes.
Yeah, I mean that those things are, those are called vapor barriers. And so the idea behind like plastic surgical gloves on your hands is that moisture doesn't get into your gloves or your mittens. And so that can work at times. You have to have a little bit more skill to make sure that you're being safe with that. Plastic bags on your feet is the same thing. I often have used that principle. And actually on our expeditions, we'll actually use just plastic bags from the grocery store as vapor barriers to help keep our feet warm.
All right. Well, thank you so much for sharing so much information.
No problem. Good luck.
Eric Larson is a polar adventurer, expedition guide, and educator whose work has brought him to the North and South Poles, as well as Mount Everest. Larson spoke with us by Skype in 2019, and you can find our conversation along with more cold weather tips at WUWM.com. We'll take one last break, then have an in-studio performance from Swedish singer and composer Sophie Dunér. Lake Effect continues in just a moment on 89.7 WUWM.
I like you and I don't. It's paradoxical, don't you think? What I love about you, it disturbs me and it thrills.
More of Lake Effect now, I'm Joy Powers. That's Swedish singer and composer Sophie Dunér. Since graduating from Boston's Berklee School of Music in 1994, Dunér has carved out a career composing and performing all over the globe. Her music is deeply rooted in jazz and improv, but she also draws on contemporary classical and world music influences. Dunér is the artist in residence this week with Milwaukee's contemporary music ensemble, Present Music. She'll perform two pieces with the group this Thursday and Friday, but before that, she and bassist John McCullough Benner stopped by the studio to talk with Lake Effect's Bonnie North.
Sophie and John, it is a pleasure to have you in Lake Effect's performance studio. Thanks so much for coming in on a Monday morning.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us. Excited to be here.
Sophie, you are an artist in residence
yes.
for Present Music. Mm-hmm. Is this the first time you have performed with them, or have you been here before?
No, I've never been to Wisconsin. I have not been in this area of the United States. I have been in many other parts, but this is the first time I will perform with Present Music, and this is the first time in the region.
It's a wonderful ensemble, and it's been around for 30-some years, doing all new music, really championing people like you who are composing and performing in sort of cross genres. You know, the piece we're going to hear has some jazz influence. It's got a lot of other things going on, but I've always found it such an amazing ensemble to have in the city here. So it's really great that you're going to be part of it.
Yes, I am truly excited. I was contacted by them last year, and it was an honor to be invited as an artist in residence, and both as mainly as a composer, but also as a singer, and as well as a visual artist, partly. So I'm very, very excited to get all my goodies in one place. It's a real treat.
How did you start as a musician? Did you start as a singer? Did you start as a composer?
I actually started as a pianist. I took classical piano lessons as a child for quite some years. And then I slid into jazz singing and composition when I started in Boston attending Berklee College of Music. And I studied jazz and improvisation. And also some parallel with my jazz studies, I did take contemporary music studies as well and participated in both jazz groups and contemporary music groups as well as world music groups. So I have a lot of different influences, but my roots are mainly from jazz and jazz improvisation.
I find it interesting that jazz and contemporary music have such an interesting crossover. They talk to each other really well, particularly that whole improvisatory part of it where you're kind of, things are written down, but there may be suggestions or there are chord charts or something, but then you can kind of go.
Yeah, it opens up a spectrum, I think, to do an interchange. I wouldn't really personally call it crossover because you're not really crossing anything, just using influences to open up the spectrum, the sea of colors to express yourself, you know? So you're influenced by things. It's exciting. It's very exciting.
I think one of the things that contemporary classical music has a bad rap for is it not being accessible, where jazz tends to be, at least in the kind of in the popular mindset. And so maybe that's what I'm thinking is like those influences together. I'm thinking of Luciano Berio from the 60s. And are you a big
Kathy
fan?
Kathy Barbarian. Oh, yeah. When I was in school, somebody told me I sounded like her, and I was invited to sing parallel, like I said earlier, with my jazz studies and my jazz focus. I was also participating in these type of ensembles because I had a voice that was quite flexible and with different timbres. And I know that her placement of voice wasn't the atypical classical positioning. So it was quite natural, just like folk voices.
With this huge range,
yes,
and with classical training, mm-hmm. and
very natural.
Very natural. And I have to say, she is a cousin
Really?
Yeah, the Barbarian side of my mother's family. Mm. Yeah, she was, for me, like a second cousin.
How
I never
exciting.
Met her.
Yes.
But I listened to her growing up, and she and my mother were very close.
Wow.
And it's just, and that's where I first heard her. And I first heard her do the Beatles.
Yes.
And so she was mm-hmm. she was willing to, as you said, pull in all those influences. And I'm so glad that you say you listened, because I could hear that in your singing, too.
Yeah, it was an early influence. Somebody introduced her to me, and it's true. She had this very natural approach for singing with joy. You know, it wasn't, she's not trying anything. It wasn't pretentious. It was just blowing it out there. And I like that kind of, in the middle of all this brainy stuff, you need this kind of raw primal approach, which I love to use when I express myself, technique, but with a kind of raw natural approach. We just blow it out there.
When you compose, are you always thinking of the voice, or are you thinking of other instruments?
I mainly compose for myself, especially mm-hmm. lately. No, I don't think so much about other instruments. Of course, it depends who I will collaborate with. You have to adapt, you know, very much so. When I initially compose a song, I very much think about my own melody and my own expression, what I need, what register that makes me sound the best and makes me sound interesting, because I like to write melodies that are on the border of not being able to make it. So I feel like I can crash land or I can just break out and joy, you know, but you have to be able to know exactly where that happens and permit the technique to just explode, you know. So it's risky, but I like risk in music because you get in touch with your emotional expression that way.
Yeah, if everything's safe all the time, it also is boring.
Yeah.
Yeah, it gets really, for the listener too, you know, it's like, oh, I know where that's going to go. So, John, this is a perfect time to bring you
sure.
in, talking about the collaboration. The song that we're going to hear, I've Got Something to Say, Is this something that you've worked on together from the beginning, or?
No, actually, this is something that that Sophie brought to Present Music. I was just contacted in the fall about doing this performance. And actually, so there was an arrangement that was brought in, and through a rehearsal last night, actually, we did a bit of collaborating and kind of changing around a couple things in order to really fit exactly what Sophie had in her head.
So the version we're hearing is pretty new. Then.
Yeah, it's a couple of 12 hour fresh out of the oven.
That's great.
Yeah.
I mean, I love that it's that flexible.
Well, that's what jazz is all about. You look at each other, you know, give each other tempo, you move the rhythm, rather than always looking at a paper. I mean, it's you can get the thing better that way, you know, because it's very much about the timing. Timing is very important. Yeah. I think it turned out great that way.
Yeah, and especially with a piece like this, you know, with just voice and bass, there's an opportunity because you've got you know both ends of the spectrum here, in really having that kind of almost like through the piece communication.
Well, watching you rehearse it, I could see that. You know, I was watching you two connect with each other through the music, and it was a lot of fun. So shall we hear it? Sophie, tell me a little bit about the song before we hear it.
Oh, it's kind of what's a song that I created it sort of based on the lyrics. I often in jazz, you know, you invent the melodies and you invent the chords and then you add the lyrics afterwards. But this was a speech. You know, I'm very much adapting the melody to the speech, especially in the beginning. So the melody is built on the lyrics. You know, I'm saying something, you know, and he's simply following me when I'm saying it, like Sprechstimme, right, with bass. But jazz, Sprechstimme. Yeah. And then finally we hit the tempo, which is line cliche that builds up. I keep speaking louder. I'm finally screaming. So that also goes with lyrics, you know. It's about making a statement. Nobody's really listening to you. So, you know, but you're still insisting on getting through the message. And then comes the grand finale, which is the chorus, which is more like, you know, it has kicks and the chords are pretty in harmony and happy. And in there, I'm just saying, the defense of a fool, which is also contrasting to the harmony, you know. But I feel like I'm you know, I'm trying to explain myself and you're still not listening, but I'm going to say it anyway. So it's a grand finale. And then there's the kind of a satire solo section. You're just hanging out. I do this anyway. So the music is very related to the lyrics in a fun way, you know.
Yeah.
So that's how I built it. It's kind of a new way of doing it. But that's a lot of energy, moving energy, you know, for me in different sections. So, yeah, that's how I wrote it, I guess. But
all
I don't
right.
think too much. It's more of an intuitive text, you know.
Well, let's hear it. I've got something to say. Sophie Dunay and John McCullough Benner in Lake Effect's Performance Studio.
I got something to say. You don't want to listen. I keep on insisting. Words keep drifting away. I got something to say. You continue to question my deepest confession. I got something to say. I keep speaking louder. I'm finally screaming the words. I got something to say. I got something to say. You don't tell me so. This issue is persistent. Words keep drifting away. Crazy, no, it ain't so. You're making me feel like the defense of a fool. The defense of a fool is my most precious tool. Something to say. You don't want to listen. Keep on it. insisting. Words keep drifting away. Crazy, no, it ain't so. You're making me feel like the defense of a fool. The defense of a fool is my most precious tool.
I've Got Something to Say performed in Lake Effect's performance studio. Sophie Dunay and John McCullough Benner, thank you. That was a great tune. And this is going to, are you performing this at the concert?
Yes, we are. Prior to another song for a string quartet that I wrote called Hey Doctor.
Are you part of that too, John?
Possibly.
Possibly.
Okay. And so since this is your first time performing here, have you met the rest of the Present Music group? Have you worked with them yet?
Not yet.
Okay. So you're just in town,
yes.
Literally.
Yes.
Walking into the studio and mm-hmm. performing. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for making us your first stop. I really appreciate that.
Well, actually, I was on, yesterday morning, I was on Arts Avenue for an interview.
Okay.
With TV. Yeah.
All right.
But I haven't been working with Present Music yet. No.
So that's a treat to still to come.
Yes, yeah. Today.
Are you going to be artist in residence for a while, or is it just during
this
week?
No, actually, I'm going to be artist in residence until Sunday, and then I'm continuing with more engagements spread out here in the United States during the year. I'm going to Puerto Rico after this for a jazz gig, and then I will be having more engagements, like I said, spread out during this year.
Are you still based in Sweden, or are you kind of...
I kind of move around. I'm based there, but I move around. I do things in England and in Spain and also
in the U.S.
I was in Berlin this spring and in the U.S. So yeah. A lot of things in the U.S. lately, because I've been getting a lot of collaborations and opportunities here, which I'm very grateful for. So, lots of different stuff happening.
Well, I hope that you'll come back.
So do I.
Yeah, I think it's a perfect fit. And I think it's just a wonderful opportunity to hear contemporary jazz, if you will. You know, I don't want to put it in a box, but, you know, really wonderful contemporary composition and performance. So I want to thank you both so much for taking time this morning to come in and play for us. And please tell me, Sophie, do you have the concert info there?
Yes, I do.
Where you're going to be and when and all of that.
So the concerts are taking place at Jens Studio. And they both start on 7:30 p.m. on Thursday and Friday. And on Friday night until midnight, there's going to be an after party.
Are you performing for that, or are you just going to get to relax?
Oh, yeah. Indeed. I hope so. There's going to be a jazz band, so I might join in.
You might have to.
Yeah.
I think it's going to be a requirement.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Oh, definitely.
Terrific.
Wouldn't want to miss that.
Well, thank you so much again.
Thank you so much, Bonnie, for having us.
Engineer Jason Reevy recorded singer and composer Sophie Dunair and bassist John McCullough Benner in Lake Effect's performance studio. Both will perform with Milwaukee's Present Music Thursday and Friday nights on Milwaukee's East Side. There's more information about the concert at WUWM.com. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for tuning in today. Please join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.